Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to our GE Capital presentation today. I'm delighted to say that we've got Mike Neal with us, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of GE Capital. So without further ado, I want to mention one more thing. As always, for the last 2.5 days, and I want to say thank you all are the diehards for sticking through on a Friday morning. I noticed a lot of faces I saw at midnight last night who I don't see here today. So I appreciate that. There are question cards on your seats, and if you could, as always, fill those out, pass them to the center of the aisle, and we'll have those brought up to the front of the room, and I will incorporate those into the Q&A session after Mike is finished. That'd be great. Thanks, everybody. Mike.
Thank you. As Steve told me, it was a big night last night. I wasn't here, so but those of you who are here, you're able to get up and make it in by the crack of 11, right, Steve, I guess? Yeah. Anyway, look, I'm going to spend about 20 minutes and just walk you through sort of things about GE Capital. I don't have anything here on GE, but just the financial services company in terms of where we are. And this is all very relevant as we're busy going through our strategic planning right now, which is what we've spent the bulk of the last 2 weeks. It's just part of the normal GE cycle that we do each year. In terms of the business, we have a strong, we believe, an advantaged business model, even maybe more advantaged today than in the past, just because the events of the last 2 years really have changed the competitive landscape for us. We strengthened our liquidity position. I'll show you more on that in a minute. We have strong risk practices. We performed well in general below the Fed base case. I've got a page on that I'll show you in a minute as well. Margins are better. Pricing is better, has been, for the last couple of years, and I'll show you that as well. Losses, we believe, in real estate, while notable, are manageable, and I'll show you that too. Regulatory reform, we pay a lot of attention to that. It's not done yet. As I tell people, until you have a wire transfer, you don't have anything. Until we have a law, we don't have anything there yet either, but we are working it, and we're prepared for it, and we're profitable. So I think we're actually feeling pretty good about the business these days. In terms of just who we are, what we do, core competencies, we really underwrite for our own book. It's a big difference, I think, between us and some others. Everything we do, even if we syndicate it or securitize it, we originate it and underwrite it as if we were going to hold it to term. And so I think it instills good behavior as opposed to originate to sell, where you, if you're only going to have the risk of the transaction for 30 days, 60 days, something like that, you get different types of behavior. We have a lot of domain, what we call really experience in these businesses, particularly in the collaterals and the markets that we're in. We have a very broad spread of risk, both globally, geographically, by collateral type, by product type. We're not a trader, and we've avoided the exotics. As I tell people, we finance ATVs, not SIV. We haven't done a lot of that. It's just not what we do. We're a finance company. We're match funded for the most part. We have a very strong brand. Some of the things that were successful for us in the crisis, we did a lot of things we think smartly, didn't do them all, but we did a lot. We exited subprime in the U.S. early. We tightened down our underwriting and the consumer book very early. It's really paid off quite well for us. We closed our warehouses down early. We did a number of things that we think have served us well through this crisis. And things that we haven't done, again, we're not a trader. We don't originate, sell, distribute some of the exotic products that are out there. We don't sell credit default insurance. We don't trade securities. We don't originate mezzanine, don't hold mezzanine, don't originate high yield. So when you think about us, even though we operate in many parts of the world, for the most part, mid-market, collateralized lender, just lending and leasing some equity. In terms of things that we learned, we were bigger than we should have been in real estate coming into the cycle. We actually felt the cycle was coming. We were not unaware of where cap rates were. We didn't stress it down to the level that real estate values actually went. We were always thinking in 20-25% decline in the book. It really went down about 40, and we weren't the only one that that saw that. Liquidity, if you go back to the fall of 2008, We were carrying about $12-15 billion of cash. We had 60% bank backup lines against about an $80 billion CP program. It wasn't enough. Today, very different for us. We have $65 billion of cash. We have our $50 billion of bank backup lines. We brought the CP program down to $45 billion, and so about 2.5 times the CP. So that's a lesson learned, and we will never have that little protection again in the business. In terms of the business model itself, we have amazing origination capacity in the business. We mostly originate with a large sales force. We have people, for the most part, that actually work, call on CFOs around the planet. So we originate our own business as opposed to buying it through third parties, intermediaries, things. So we originate it ourselves. We underwrite ourselves. We have deep domain. We're the biggest in the world in areas like aircraft. We have an enormous energy finance business, healthcare, things that we just know a lot. And in many cases, because of our relationship with GE, we have added domain because you have the large industrial presence as well as the financial services company. We're good at collateral. We're mostly a collateralized lender, so it's something we've always, not new. We've been doing this since the 30s. We do it today. We're good at it. We're very good at risk management. We have 7,000 risk professionals in the business. We underwrite everything and have fared well from a credit standpoint coming through the crisis. We're very operationally minded. We took a lot of costs out of the business, $5 billion of structural costs out of the business over the last 2 years. We're match funded. And if you think of the business before and after, we're much the same today in terms of those capabilities as we were when we were going into the crisis. Now, we do have a plan to make the business smaller. I'll talk more about that in a minute. And we're ahead of plan, actually, in that, taking out, reducing E&I by over $50 billion just last year. Some of the things we do, and again, I talk about, these are boring charts, I think, because what we do largely is boring, but this shows CLL. This is our pole business. This is the Americas. This is our commercial lending and leasing business, what many people think of when they think of GE Capital. Shows you the profitability in 08, what happened to the business in 09, and where we are in Q1. This business is recovering very quickly from the crisis. But what do they do? Franchise financing. They do leasing, lending. We don't do anything too big. We're the biggest in mid-market LBOs, but we don't do the big ticket area. So again, very Main Street focus. We're organized by product and industry. We have over 400,000 customers, and again, this business is actually is performing very nicely right now. GECAS, this is our commercial aviation business. We've been in this business for a very long time. We're the biggest in this space, about 1,400 planes. That we have. The business, as you can see, earned over $1 billion net back in 2008, also last year as well. It's held up very nicely. This is a good example, I think, of where the world has changed for GECAS. There were four large aircraft. There's a lot of aircraft players, but there were four large ones in the space. GECAS, which is doing very well today. AIG, which is repositioning. CIT, which is repositioning, and of course Royal Bank of Scotland, which is 84% owned by the UK, and they've announced that they're exiting some of this business as well. So there's less competition in this space today vis-a-vis what there was 2 years ago. Great business for us, one we like a lot. We only have three, for instance, today, three aircraft on the ground, so this is a very well-managed business. This is our U.S. Consumer business. This is something, there are a lot of questions about this business going into the crisis. It's performed very well for us. When we exited subprime back in early days of the crisis, we tightened down the underwriting standards in this business too. You can see the graph on the left, how it performed vis-a-vis just the composite index. And we don't name names here, but the business is doing quite well, had a very good first quarter. In fact, the best first quarter in the history of the private label credit card business for us, which again is just a U.S. business, at least that's what's represented here. And you can see the numbers for yourself. It's doing quite well. These are our metrics. These are the ones that most people are interested in. And you can see where we are in terms of funding the business. Our CP program, which had been at one time over $100 billion, down now to 46, and we're still reducing it. Leverage down in the 5 range, so not very highly levered. Our Tier 1 ratios compare well, very competitively with the banks that you follow. And then our ending net investment, $50 billion reduction last year. We're going to bring E&I for GE Capital down to 440-ish by the end of 2012 as we refocus the business. In terms of volume and margins, pretty strong. You can see global volume last year, $313 billion, $41 billion with just small biz in the U.S. So we do matter. We're a lender of some importance in the space. Our margins are improving. I mentioned that earlier. You can see both the commercial and the consumer. And to the far right, I think, is probably the most important graph I have, because when people talk to me about margins in the business, the time I was most concerned back, if you go back to 2004, 5, and 6, as you had sort of the unfettered access by capital markets into the space, which was reducing margins, causing people to take more risk in that regard. So even though we were doing quite well profitable from a profitability standpoint, the margin in the portfolio itself was dropping during that period of time as things got more and more competitive. That ended in the fall of 2008. And as you can see, pricing for us is up, margins for us is up, and the portfolio, the profitability in the portfolio, has now actually changed and is going back up, which is a huge, that's the annuity in our book, and it's a huge deal for us or for any other financial services company. This shows you where we are, Fed base case estimate, Fed adverse case in total, as we've stressed the business. If you annualize Q1, we're running below that. So we feel pretty good. U.S. consumer, better. U.K. mortgage, an area of a lot of focus last year, a lot of concern, earned $40 million net for us in the first quarter. U.K. Mortgage housing prices in the U.K. have risen every month since August but one. So again, a reasonable position from a collateral standpoint. And then commercial real estate, still challenged, and we're very sober about that book. But it seems to be in a bottoming process. We do operate it in almost 30 countries around the world, and not all alike. But we feel like we're bottoming in that. We believe that our losses will peak this year and then better days ahead. Shows you a bit on the portfolio, and again, trending better from last year. Equipment delinquencies better, down two consecutive quarters for us. Consumer delinquencies better. Real estate delinquencies are up, likely will be until unemployment, and as you probably saw in this morning's report, unless you're a census worker, unemployment has not, it's going to be with us, I think, for a while. That, over time, drives issues in commercial real estate because, you know, the amount of cubicles that go dark, rents get renegotiated down. So the way I think about commercial real estate, we're probably largely through just the free fall in asset values. Now you're in more in terms of real defaults as people can't renew. Cash flows aren't what they were in some of these properties. And that's going to be with us for a while, but it's manageable, we think, for us. This just shows you in terms of our book. NOI about a wash versus last year. The debt margin is quite good. There's not a lot of lending in the space. Gains about the same as last year. Depreciation, as you can see, is worse. Occupancy is better. We worked this. We've shifted the entire business to focus on occupancy in our properties. Leasing, pretty good, but it was pretty good for us last year. The chart on the right we have not shown, I don't think. Trevor, have you shown it? I think this shows you in terms of the unrealized loss in the equity book, again, an area that gets a lot of focus from us. $7 billion last year, value decline about another billion, depreciation, and then, of course, defaults, losses in that book. It'll be in the 6.5 to 7, so it'll decline this year versus last year. So I thought you might be curious about that. We get a lot of questions these days about Europe, this morning about Hungary in that regard. Most of what we have in these countries that you're curious about, this is sovereign exposure. You know, we are lending, leasing, it's aircraft, it's copiers, there's some properties from that standpoint. Italy, it's a bank, a commercial bank that we own, Interbanca, from that standpoint. So this is our exposure, 75% secured lending, no major concentration risk, very little sovereign exposure, and delinquencies actually were down 10 basis points. In April versus Q1, so nothing really alarming for us in that. Hungary, I got a question earlier about that. We have about $4 billion exposure in Hungary. It's primarily the Bank of Budapest, which we own, and it earned, I think, about $65-70 million net for us. So again, not a material. I don't really know what's going on in Hungary or not. I read the papers just like you do, but the bank actually is doing pretty well for us, so that's sort of kind of a current position. In terms of how I think about Europe, again, we have about $140 billion in assets, so we're a large European mid-market lender in that. So to the extent that this causes an overall economic malaise on the continent, we get impacted by that. because it'll, you know, it'll be tougher for our customers in that regard. But it's not big exposures, sovereign exposures. Just not what we do. We lend, we lease, we operate in these markets, and that's how we would get impacted by any kind of a decline in that market. Regulatory reform, we spend a lot of time. For those of you who watch C-SPAN, you saw me get to testify here 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm sure all of you saw that. In terms of how we think about it, Fed is our consolidated supervisor. You know, I think we're ready for that if that's what happens. I tell people all the time, we're supervised by the OTS. I am more concerned about the regulations than the regulator. Quite frankly, whatever the regulations are, we will comply with them. And so who our regulator is, to me, is interesting, but it's not the gating factor. We're ready. We're ready for that. Whatever happens, and by the way, until you get a law here, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen in this space. It changes every time something comes out. Resolution authority, we think that's a good thing. Derivatives, we have about $300 billion derivative book, so it's important. But our derivative, we're not in the business of derivatives. We use it to hedge our risks. So these are currency swaps. These are, very simple. You know, if we have a transaction in Australia, we raise the money in the U.S., we swap into that currency. If we have a floating rate deal, we raise fixed rate money, we swap into that. So that's the bulk of what we do from a derivative standpoint. And again, we'll have to see what actually comes out, what gets into the law in terms of how that gets impacted. But we are an end user of derivatives, but we're not a small, but compared to some of the banks, we're actually quite small. Consumer protection, we think that's probably a good thing as well. Preemption is a big deal, though, we think, in that. But again, until that's all said and done, we don't know exactly how that works. But we're largely where we think this is going to be, so we're pretty good with it. Volcker, we're not a trader, which I think is largely where this is aimed at. But we'll have to wait to see what the language is. I mean, could it impact equity investing in energy projects? Maybe. Could it impact other types of equity investing we may do? It could. I don't think that's the point of it, but as I tell my team, until we actually see the language that goes into law, we don't know exactly. But it's not aimed, we think, at a, we've been told that, and we'll just have to wait to see where that goes. But we are ready for this. We are largely been moving the business this way for the last 2 years, and we'll just have to see where this ultimately ends up. In terms of the outlook for the business, revenues this year, this is outlook versus plan on the first. Revenue's been a little hard to come by, although they're picking up now in Q2, so we feel better about it. We're actually ahead of plan on our E&I reduction. Margins, pretty good. I mentioned that earlier. ROIs are holding up in many of the product lines around 3. Volume up about 20% versus last year, although we thought they'd be a little higher this year. The second one, not inconsistent with the first one. First one was versus plan. Second one versus last year. So we were actually hoping, but we are up 20. And again, Q2 better than Q1, we think, although Q2 is not over. Losses better, real estate about what we thought. Delinquency rates, as I showed you earlier, are behaving and trending down. Expenses, we've worked hard on our expense base, and we've taken about $5 billion of structural costs out of the business. Pre-tax earnings are better. Earnings overall are better. And in terms of how we see it versus last year, with the exception of commercial real estate, where we're not out of the woods yet, and that everything else is trending better than planned, better than what we were thinking about coming into the year. Real estate still, but I have to tell you, though, our real estate team is one of the most talented teams in the company. It's just the toughest market that I've ever seen in my lifetime. We just never imagined, or at least I never imagined, values that could drop as much as they have in many of the places that people operate in that. Last page, in terms of just, you know, how we think about the business. Funding-wise, I mentioned earlier, we have $65 billion of cash. Our CP program, which is only about 10% of our funding stack, is down in the $45 billion. We have $50 billion of bank lines behind us. Some of the questions I get is, you know, with the disruption in Europe, is that about, we don't need to borrow and won't need to borrow. We would like to continue to pre-fund next year, but we have no short-term issues with that. We have high margin origination. I think the competitive landscape for us is different. We will certainly, well, maybe not certainly, but we're going to be one of the largest, maybe the only really large surviving FinCo in the world when this is over. So I think that positions us pretty well. Delinquencies have stabilized. Reserve coverage near all-time high. For anybody here that's followed us for any length of time. If you go back 15, 20 years ago, we used to always carry 263 and 2.63% reserves. It's just how we did it. The SEC changed that about 10 years ago, and reserves then go with incurred losses. And today, our reserves, and I never thought I would see it again in my career, back at about 261. So we're very close to where we were back 10, 15 years ago in terms of percent. Very high for us. Capital ratios are improving for us and will continue to improve. So we think we have a very strong franchise from an origination standpoint. We do originate our own transactions. We think that's a real advantage for us. We really have an industrial headset in terms of how we go about the business, how we operate. We're very good risk managers. We're very good asset managers. We think that serves us well, has served us well through this crisis. We're in attractive markets, and we believe we're in a less competitive world, at least for a while, in terms of just some of the things that have happened in this marketplace. And so with that, Steve, that's all I have prepared.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. It's a helpful overview. I know you referred to it early on, but let me start with a relatively strategic question. And again, just to remind everybody, I have received a number of cards. But if you have additional cards, please raise your hands with those cards. We'll get those up here. Stepping back, you talked about the lessons that you've learned through this crisis. And I think, you know, you mentioned size, transparency. But really, strategic and operationally, the lessons that you're going to take away for the rest of your life, having lived through the last couple of years, what are those big takeaways that impact also GE Capital's culture, how you do business, and effectively what makes GE Capital different now in going forward in terms of how you do business?
Well, I think I mentioned a couple. You know, I wish we didn't have as much real estate as we do. We should have. We talked about it. We met. We spent a lot of time on real estate. We just didn't stress it as far as what actually happened in that regard. I think from a liquidity standpoint, you know, the AAA metric for us was the way we operated, 60%. Backup lines against that turns out in this type of event just was not enough. Something I didn't mention earlier, a personal learning for me, having been in the business for over 30 years, we take a lot of comfort, a lot of people do, in spread of risk, whether it's by collateral type, product type, geography. You don't want to have so much of something somewhere where if it gets away from you, it causes a big event in the business. So we spend a lot of time working the portfolio diversity of the company. In a crisis like the one we went through, which is the most severe I've seen, everything kind of correlates to one. So there was less protection from a diversity standpoint because everything got troubled, everywhere got troubled, everything was linked. So I would say that, you know, one of the things I learned personally about this is that you can't rely as much just on a diversified portfolio in terms of something like this because it can all go.
And does the relationship that you have with GE corporate parent, has that also shifted in any way over the last couple of years and now?
Well, I'm not as popular as I was, but I won't be funny about that. I would say not really. I mean, we're an important GE business. We've been a huge provider of income over a very long period of time for the company. We went through a very tough patch in that regard. You should know if you don't. Most of our business, most of the things that we do, is not financing GE. We do some financing of GE products, but in large, when you think of a captive finance company, it's not the right way to think about us. It's only about 5% of what we do, so 95% not that in that regard. But I think GE is an enormous source of strength for us. We weren't in TARP. GE put capital into. I mean, GE really was our TARP. From that standpoint, as they put money into the business, enormous source of strength for us. We operate the business with the same intensity, same procedures, same software, if you will, as the rest of the company, which I think gives us a little different headset than others in the business. So I would just say that GE is I'm a 31-year GE employee, so an enormous source of strength for us and how our verticals, for instance, it advantages us. I mean, the idea that we have a large energy finance business and we are part of the largest energy company, manufacturing company in the world, is an enormous source of knowledge and strength. I like to talk about it that it gives us a little higher IQ in these spaces. We do that in media. We do that in aviation. We're the largest manufacturer of jet engines in the world. It helps GECAS to have that affiliation, to have that common knowledge base in the company. So I think we have a little higher IQ in the areas where we operate in the same spaces that the parent does.
Okay, if we turn back to Europe for a second before we get into some of the number questions. GE Capital, you mentioned before, about $140 billion of assets in Europe, and from the slide I saw, plus Hungary, maybe $25 billion-$30 billion in those specific countries. Are you seeing the credit cycle turning yet? How does that translate itself into risk, and what is the impact of the euro on translation at 120, and should you go deeper?
Well, I would say for us, there was a lot of questions in that one
card.
But when you look around the world, most of the places we operate in Asia, except for Japan, didn't experience very much of this at all. We have a large operation in Korea. They had about a three-day recession in Korea. So the Asian businesses are strong. Australia performed very strongly through this. We see the U.S. market recovering pretty nicely, and Q1 was good for us here. Europe's slower, and maybe that's just one of those truisms. You hear it a lot that we go in first, we come out first, other places. But I think Europe is slower, and what's going on right now certainly is going to exacerbate that. In terms of our exposure, about $140 billion, most of the things that we do in the United States, we do in Europe. We operate primarily in the big countries, so we're a big U.K. business, we're a big French business, we're a big German business. We own three pretty big banks in Central Europe. We have Czech Agribank in the Czech Republic. We have Bank of Budapest in Hungary and BHP in Poland. That's the bulk of our assets there. In terms of impact of the euro and decline, about $10 billion in terms of assets, probably $1.5 billion, Trevor, in terms of capital from the devaluation, I would say, is where we are today. And it could go lower, so.
Just to be specific, that's assuming a what, a 1.2 euro?
Rough math. Yeah.
$2 billion at 1.2? Okay. And you're saying that's the equity impact, right?
Equity.
Okay. And then in terms of, are you seeing, though, in your credit businesses in Europe, delays, any trends getting worse over the last couple of months?
Well, again, not really. I showed the one chart on the countries that are the most concerning, and actually the delinquency there was a little better. I think it's a longer-term problem, I think. And it really depends, I think, in just how the translation of these issues, does that become a very heavy, wet blanket on commerce in that part? That will impact us. It will impact our customers, and in some cases may impact our collateral, but we don't see that yet. I would say what we do see in Europe is the volume, the new volume, the new business is slower than what we're seeing in the U.S. and in Asia.
Maybe a question on pricing, and then get into some of the cost lines and funding. On pricing, so you mentioned before, you're one of the last fincos, MBFIs left standing. Originations have been much higher. Spreads, ROIs been getting better for a while. You showed a little bit of information on that, on them still looking okay. I understand in the market, though, that there's been pressure around pricing, broadly speaking. How do you think about NIMs now, where they're headed going forward?
Well, I think there was a period of time during the last 2 years where hardly anyone was lending. To the extent you were willing to lend, you could pretty well dictate the terms of what that might be and the pricing of what that may be. If you didn't do the deals because the deal probably just didn't happen, it wasn't so much that there was a lot of competition. That's not the way it is today. There is more competition. The banks are trying to lend. So while the market, I would say, Steve, is still much more attractive from a pricing and term standpoint than it was, say, in 2006, it is getting more competitive, and eventually will normalize, I think. The thing that will be different this time is that, because there will be a lot of things are never things are never forever in anything I say about financial services, but because competition will come back, things will revert. But it may be a very long time before we see capital markets return to what they were if you go back to 2006 and 2007. And that actually created, wasn't really the banks, it really, capital markets, the ability for pools of structured capital to find their way to an end user. That put a lot of pressure because it's this whole originate to distribute model. It put a lot of pressure on the terms, the amount of leverage in that transaction, the type of covenants that transaction may have, what the hurdle rates were from a pricing standpoint. And there were moments in time when that was half the market. And, of course, that went to zero here in 2009. It'll come back, but I suspect in my lifetime, I won't see it like that again. And that's really, I think, what caused the pricing to erode so much.
You talked maybe a year or so ago with me about raising the hurdle rates internally on pricing. Mm-hmm. Have you stepped off of that now? Have you taken them down internally?
We put one of the nice things about my job is since we have our own salespeople and we're not dealing through others, I can change pricing with an email. And so we can actually turn this thing very quickly. And back in 2008, when we realized the market we were going to be in, how hard capital was going to be to come by, we said, "Well, we're going to take pricing up," and we did. And the sales force squealed about it, but they really have no choice in that regard. So we changed our pricing model. Today, it's been relaxed some. At that time, we took it up nothing below a 3 ROI. And today, it depends on the business; they're not all the same. But the guidelines we give all the businesses and the policy on it is to stay north of a 2, some higher than that, some still above 3, depending on the market that they're in. But it is a more competitive world today than it was 18 months ago or 12 months ago. Having said that, it's not nearly as competitive as it was 3 years ago.
And the current environment in Europe is not causing you to sort of reconsider that based on what you said before.
On pricing? Or?
Yeah, on pricing.
No, not really.
Okay. All right, maybe get into on credit a bit. I just want to talk some of the questions I get frequently from investors is about extending and pretending. To what extent, and we certainly hear that on banks and concerns around GE Capital as well, to what extent is GE Capital extending terms, delaying charge-offs, kicking the can down the road on your loan book in an effort to repair troubled loans? And how, what evidence can you point to in order to comfort investors that this is not happening in the portfolio?
Yeah, I would answer. I don't really have any evidence to point to, but I can tell you that the way we treat our customers is no different today than it's ever been. You end up with some phraseology that is not very flattering, like extend and pretend. But the fact is that we look at our customers. If they have a plan, if they're creditworthy, if we think it's a customer of some value, if we have collateral that we think has real value in the market, then we try to work with and always have our customers. Foreclosure is the last thing that we actually want to have happen most times in how we think about it. So when you say extend and pretend, I think for us, if we have a real customer, if we have a good view of the underlying collateral, the transaction, if we can work with them and keep it working, then we do. But that's no different today than it was in 2005, 2019, 95. It's how we operate from that standpoint. If we don't have those things, we foreclose. And that's true in LBOs, and it's true in real estate. It's how we do it.
I would just add one thing to what Mike said there, is that we have, as of the first quarter, $1.6 billion of reserves on our credit book in commercial real estate. And of that, 73% of those reserves, people are paying current and always have paid current. So what we've done is we've looked at the next 2 years of people who are going to be refinance risk, and we've brought those properties down to a level of where we think there may be a refinancing risk, and that's, so of the 1.6, 73% are still paying current.
Okay, that's helpful, and thanks for taking that question well. In terms of driving towards earnings, one question that some investors had in the audience, or how should investors think about that $5 billion you mentioned in cumulative cost reduction given the shrinking of the business, and how much impact, what's left, and how much runway is left in there?
In terms of future cost reduction, we still work it, and there's still a tail on some of the actions that we took early. We were very aggressive on exiting some platforms. We were aggressive on reducing our variable costs in the business. The bulk of that, I think, is behind us. We think we're operating today very efficiently. We will work, I think, as things improve, to not let those costs creep back into the business. I think we are operating at a $5 billion cost base lower than what we were 2 years ago. A year from now, we'll still have most of that $5 billion out of the company as we move into a better market. It's just positioned us as a more competitive player. It was very important for us that, as impacted as we were in this market, had we not done these cost actions, it would have been much more severe.
Given the shrinking asset base, people should think about that cost reduction as, you're saying, mostly permanent, but there may be some cost.
It's different too. As we continue to shrink, as we go to 440, we're going to exit businesses, we're going to exit platforms, we will sell businesses. That'll all exit the system too. Some of what we've done, and I'm sure some of the companies that you're involved have done the same thing. We took a hard look at our business back 2008, 2009, in terms of what's the best part of it, what are the parts that are least attractive, with an idea of getting the company smaller and more focused in that regard. We've got a very focused effort, a big team, all reporting to one person of what we call our restructuring assets. We have a plan to reduce our E&I to 440 between now and the end of 2012. Some of it will be sold as exited as platforms. Some of it will be, we'll just collect it and not originate new business into it. A lot of cost will come out. Steve, I don't have a number for you, but a lot of cost will come out as we exit these platforms.
Okay. Let's maybe stick on the portfolio for a second then, given that. Is real estate still considered core for capital? You're talking equity versus debt. Let's start there. What's in the portfolio? What goes, what stays? What's your current view of that?
Well, today we're just trying to run what we have well. We're only putting new capital to work in that business. We're not trying to grow it to the extent it supports CapEx, supports a particular property from that standpoint. We are exiting properties as we can. The business, and we don't have a hard view today on real estate. You should know our real estate company, even though it's been very impacted by these markets, is one of our best businesses. We have a great team in real estate. It's one of the reasons that the result is, even though troubled, is not worse than that. It's one of our better teams. It's been a core product line for us for many decades. We've made a lot of money in that business. If you look at it over time, it's been quite profitable, even including the last 2 years. Having said that, the business should be down below 10% of assets in that range. We will move to make it smaller. We'll do that largely by exiting properties as it makes sense for us. We have $80 billion-ish today. The thinking, and these aren't hard plans yet, but the thinking around that business should be $40 billion-$50 billion more debt, less equity in that book. That's how we think about it.
What year do you think investors should start thinking that we'll start seeing meaningful transactions?
I think it just depends. We're going to do things as we think they make sense. The book actually is a very high-quality book. We originate in almost 30 countries around the world. Most of our problems actually have been in the United States in terms of net income impact. Although this is, I don't have a chart on it, but you have value drops that have been in a range from down 25 to down 40, depending on the market. We're working this, and as it makes sense, we'll continue to work it. We're also going to transition the business more to an asset management model, at least in part. We're busy doing that today, setting up some platforms. That'll take a while for it to have a meaningful impact on the business. Some of the model will shift to that.
One of the investor questions was about your ability to take back and manage properties that have troubled loans and manage those yourself, and maybe comment on how much that happens or doesn't.
It doesn't happen that often, but we can do it. Again, it's one of our advantages because of who we are. We're a very operationally focused company. It's not true just in real estate. It's true in energy. We own power plants. If we had to run them, we could. It's because of the strength that we have with GE. We have a lot of property managers in the company, so we're not afraid of that either. We are staffed to do this. Some of this comes out of the fact that we have a large equity portfolio, and those we manage just as a normal course of the business. It doesn't bother me to think that way. It's like our GECAS. We don't finance airlines. We lease airplanes. It's the way to think about it. We would not have large exposures to some airlines if it weren't for that collateral. And we can move that collateral in a hurry. The airline industry is one that has troubles from time to time, yet we earned over $1 billion in it last year because, again, we're focused on the collateral. We have no issue with picking up planes, changing planes, reconfiguring planes, moving planes around the world. It's what we do, and it's true wherever it's appropriate inside of GE Capital.
And in terms of the other parts of the business that go or stay,
mm-hmm.
Outside of the consumer business is one that's been discussed previously, right?
Well, not
private label credit cards, things like that.
Yes, I mean we have a restructuring book. So what's in that book? Some of our equipment, some of the rental businesses, trailer leasing, container, things like that. These are all in businesses that we will exit over time. Some will be shrinkage. In the real estate book, we are in the process of exiting small operations around the world that small and at a distance generally we think doesn't work for us very well. One thing I've learned, you asked earlier, in this world, small operations at a distance, you can't earn very much, even at a 2%, but you can write the whole balance sheet off. So we will operate in places that matter, with businesses that matter. So some of the positions, joint ventures that we may have, we own a 20%. You probably read about this. We own a 21% stake in Garanti, which is a wonderful bank in Turkey. We're in the process of exiting that, and so we have other things like that as well that we'll exit.
Let's talk about funding for a minute and leverage. Maybe first on the funding side, some questions from the audience around match funding and the fact that you talk about that, but the inability of the company to roll CP, and if you were match funded, why did you need to? And how do you think about match funding in the future, given a lot of CP investors are basically investing short in the market or being told to do that?
Well, you know, the CP is a small part of our stack. I think it gets a lot of attention because of all the focus on wholesale funding, but it's 10% of our stack from that standpoint.
You're talking $50 billion, right?
45 to 50. And it'll reduce more over time. We're working. We have $100 billion, for instance, of alternative funding. Covered bonds, certificates of deposit, deposits in the business. So we try to match fund. We're not completely matched. We work it hard. We're probably more than most for that. The philosophy in the company is to try to only take the risk of the credit and the risk of the collateral, not the risk of the currency, not the risk of the term, not the risk of the type of product, floating versus fixed, something of that nature. So we only have one treasury. Everything we do runs back through that one treasury. That does not reside in these individual P&Ls for us. They fund the company, and they work within their policies to have the business be as matched funded as we can be, again, with the idea that we want to make the call on the credit, we want to make the call on the collateral. That's what we do. We're a secured lender, but not on these other things. We try to hedge that risk out of the business.
And when you talk about that long-term leverage that you're trying to achieve, how much more deleveraging do you have to do to get there? And what does this mean for dividend and cash back up to the parent to maintain that leverage ratio?
Well, I would just say that our plan is to restore dividend to the parent. I think Jeff talked about that here a few weeks ago. We don't have a date certain on that, but obviously it's driven mostly by pre-tax earnings in the business as those recover, and they are recovering from that standpoint. In terms of deleveraging of the company, we've deleveraged quite a bit. Today we're in the mid-fives in terms of the leverage of the company. That works well for us. We can hit these returns with that. If you go back and you look at GE Capital historically, it's been in the 8-9 range in terms of the leverage, so it's what we call safe and secure. Our ratios, I had the one chart that showed a few of them. We are competitive with people that we compare ourselves against. So we think we're in a pretty good place.
And so, I mean, sticking on that then, competitively, when you're competing your wholesale funding model versus banks going forward, you're saying you don't think you need that to change dramatically, or how are you thinking about that?
Well, I think what we think what we're doing now works. We are a wholesale funded model. We do have some deposits. For instance, our U.S. consumer business resides in one of our Utah banks, which is funded by deposits, so it's not funded by commercial paper from that, so it puts no pressure on the system. Today, where we are, based on the best advice we can get, having that program down to in the mid-40s where it is, the best advice that we get is that even in a reoccurrence of 2008, that because of the smaller size of the program and the strength of the 100% ownership by GE, that is manageable from that standpoint. We also now have $45 billion of short-term borrowings in CP. We have $60-plus billion of cash, $50-plus billion of backup lines. So we're just not as exposed as we were. We're not spending too much time worrying about Europe, although Europe is trouble because we just don't have to deal with it in the short term. We're funding into 11 now, not funding for next month into the business. So we've made the business much safer from a funding standpoint, and we think that's sustainable.
Now, you had fully funded 2010, you know, fairly early,
yeah.
In 2009. Are you hoping to get to the same point for 2011 this year?
We would like to stay ahead of it, and so we are working it. We're not unaware of what's going on. So we do it when it works, when it's advantage. You may have seen we had an offering in Canada yesterday that went well, as I understand it. And we'd like to stay ahead of it, Steve. We'd like to continue to work to make investors feel that the company has a. It's not inexpensive. I mean, there is a cost to carrying a lot of cash. As I like to call it, it's kind of the fool's carry trade. You know, you borrow it and you keep it in your office. From that, so there's a cost to doing that. But we do think it's a very safe way to think about the business, and we'll continue to do that until things change.
A couple of longer term questions. Well, one, how does the world change with the Fed as your regulator for you? And obviously, there are a lot of amendments right now that are being kicked around. You talked about it.
Yeah.
You talked about each piece of legislation, or each aspect of it. But how does the world change for you other than just higher capital levels? And what are your expectations for that?
Well, I don't think that's going to be with the Fed. I mean, it's going to be with what the new rules are from that. I mean, today we're not unregulated. Sometimes it gets characterized that way, or that we have the OTS and somehow they're not up to the task or the same level of regulation light. It's just not. I actually don't think any of that's true. We deal with both the Fed. We have the Fed involved with us. We deal with the OTS. We actually got the OTS, believe it or not, because of the. I don't want to make it complicated, but the FSA, as we became bigger in Europe, wanted us regulated in the U.S. by somebody that they gave equivalency to the FSA. So the FSA worked with us, and they gave the OTS equivalency. That's how that all came about some years ago. Now, I don't know exactly how this is going to change in that regard, but I think we are prepared for it. We have hired and work, and we're staffing up. We think we know within a bandwidth where these regulations are likely to go. We're prepared for it. In most cases, we're already there. In that regard, and in terms of our new regulator, whatever that turns out to be, however we are classified, in this we think we're there and ready for it. So.
Okay, two more questions, Mike. One on tax rate. How should investors think about that? I mean, there's a structural tax benefit that the company talks about, $400 million or so per quarter, and you've had 7 straight quarters of benefits. So how should we think about that going forward for GE Capital and the sustainability?
Just under the heading of empathy, our tax return's 25,000 pages. I do my own taxes, but I don't do that one. But I can answer your question. Most of our rate in the financial services company comes from something called deferral. Essentially, it puts us on a we're a large global company to the extent that we elect to keep those earnings outside the U.S. We're not subject to U.S. tax rate on it. It is the way the rest of the world operates. Our tax rate last year different because of the problems with losses and whatnot. But our tax rate in a normal year looks a lot like our global competitors. From around the world, the U.S. is the one of the few places in the world where you have this as a topic. A German bank, a Japanese bank, even if they bring the profits back to Germany or to Japan, they only pay the local tax rate. I mean, so when we talk about this, it's really around the issue of competitiveness. It affects all U.S. firms from that standpoint. You may have seen that it was in the extender package last week from the Congress, so it's not through there yet. This, by the way, it's not a lot of fun for us because it gets it's 1 year at a time. It didn't used to be that way, but our idea around taxes is I need to be competitive with Deutsche Bank. I need to be competitive with Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi. You know so do the other banks, other operations here in this country that operate globally. And so we talk about it more as a matter of being on a level playing field. We're the only country in the world where you have this issue and it comes up year to year to year. That may all get changed with a larger tax reform bill, and maybe the U.S. will move more towards a territorial system like other countries in the world are. But that's the bulk of why our tax rate is low. It's how we fund ourselves. It's the amount of business we do outside the U.S., the fact that we don't bring those earnings back. And then, of course, last year, the tax rate was very low, principally because GE and GE Capital filed one consolidated tax return. So as we had losses, we had profits in the industrial businesses and that made that an anomaly. In a normal year, if you look at our rates and compare it against a large global competitor, Hong Kong, Shanghai Bank, they're very similar.
And last question around longer-term normalized earnings. You know, what do they look like? What is the new normal ROA, ROE for GE Capital?
Normal is going to change, right, depending on where it goes. The way I think about the business today is this: when we get to the end of 12, when we're at $440 billion of ENI, the way we think about it, the way we talk about it, that's a two-ish ROI kind of business on at least how they originate, not the legacy. It'll take a while but the new originations, two plus in that regard to get the business to that basis. That gets helped too, just from the standpoint that we're exiting the businesses that we're the least profitable and least apt at in that regard. When I think about it, we'll have a two. ROI platform of businesses in a normal environment, which today looks very achievable.
Great. Mike, thanks very much for coming. Trevor, appreciate it. Thank you, everybody.